Welcome to the Social Science Sampler. I'm Stan Rhodes, and today with us we have Abby Cisneros-Kidd. Abby, I thought we'd just go right into it and ask you why you pursued grad school and why you pursued a PhD.
Sure. Thanks, Stan. Thanks for having me with you guys today. In my former life, before I pursued my PhD specifically, I was a middle school and high school science teacher. So my master's is actually in education, and I enjoyed teaching, but it left me wanting a little bit more. I love the physical classroom time, but I felt like I still had more to learn and contribute scientifically. So I went back to school and ended up at Utah State University to pursue my PhD, and I believe our degree title now is Environment and Society. It was a bigger mouthful before. I won't even try to remember what it was.
So once you have your PhD, which you're very close to having,
yes.
what is your path? What are you planning to do with it?
I am probably going to be staying in academia. That's the goal in my field, which is, even though my degree title is Environment and Society, our field is called Recreation Ecology. You can take a bunch of different paths. So you can pursue academia, you can go into government work, so working with a federal agency like the National Park Service. Some people work for nonprofits as well. There are several recreation-related nonprofits like the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics or the Access Fund that also look for research scientists. But I think I'm going to pursue academia. I like teaching.
And as you pursue academia, and you are a full-blooded and degreed social scientist, what is being a social scientist going to mean to you? What do you see it as?
That's a good question. So again, my field is recreation ecology. So for me, being a social scientist is understanding both how people interact with each other and the environment in a recreation setting. So in my case, that is parks and protected areas.
That's an interesting take for sure. So I think that a lot of people wouldn't think of outdoor recreation or recreation ecology as like an area where social science was important, at least initially, particularly because recreation ecology doesn't have any word in it that indicates the social science. But of course, social science is important there because who's recreating?
Right, it's people.
What's the big picture of why social science is important to that work?
So in my mind, because I work in social science in the context of recreation, recreation is all social science, right? So recreation ecology and that term, I think actually the textbook definition is the study of impacts that result to the environment as a result of recreational activities, right? So you're right, there isn't anything there that is inherently social in nature, but when you're on the ground in a park or protected area, it's all social in nature. So it's not just humans interacting with the environment, it's how the environment influences people's behavior and decision making. So things like terrain features and the plants and animals on the ground that people are maybe at a park to experience, how that affects their experience, and then how the interplay between visitors and other visitors affects their experience as well. So there's a huge social factor.
Well, let's talk about going out to the field and looking at humans and their impact and how they interact with each other. So a lot of graduate students engage in field work, but people don't always talk about that a lot. They're not always sure what that means. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the experience that you've had for field work and what you think about it in the context of what you study.
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, field work has entailed specifically going into national parks, although some rec ecologists also work in other protected areas like national forests or state parks or other federally or provincially protected landscapes. So I go into national parks and we use visitor surveys, so questionnaires, to try to understand people's experiences in parks, and then we also collect data about impacts to park and protected area resources that we observe as a result of visitor behavior. So it's a lot of fun because I get to interact with people when they're on their vacation, and they're happy, and they generally like to participate in the research. I know a lot of social scientists work in areas like understanding energy or other types of social impacts that are not as fun to study and maybe more difficult when you're talking with people face to face.
Yeah, I'm a little jealous of that field because, of course, with the stuff that I'm looking at institutions, I'm not so likely to go out to a national park, but I'd certainly like to. Let's talk for a second about the visitor behavior in particular. So if we're talking about visitor behavior, we have different ways of thinking about that, different models and different ways of studying it. And I know that your work addresses some of the differences between these different types of behavior, different ways of looking at behavior. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think your question is getting a little bit at theory of behaviors there. So recreation as a whole and the study of recreation, especially the human components and the human interaction with the environment, is very much steeped and informed by theory. So you have things like motivation theory that are looking at the psychological outcomes of recreation and people's experiences, maybe the benefits that they reap from recreation. The theory that I have been working with, a couple different theories that inform visitors' spatial behaviors and patterns of spatial behavior.
So let's just stop you there for a second. What do you mean by visitor spatial behavior and that
right.
sort of thing?
So visitor spatial behavior are people's patterns of movement through time and space in a park or protected area. And that's something that is important to park and protected area managers because where people are going, how long they're spending there, that can dictate how people are impacting park and protected area resources and other visitors' experiences, right?
Okay.
So now that we have that term spatial behavior defined, I've looked at a couple different theories to try to understand and frame visitor spatial behavior. And one that's been used pretty widely in just understanding the nature of people's behavior and changing behavior in general is the theory of planned behavior.
Okay.
And specifically in parks and protected areas, that's been applied in the past to trying to manage visitor behavior and understand how the theory of planned behavior could inform the development of messaging. So things like signs or even a message delivered by a uniformed volunteer, for example, could maybe potentially change people's behaviors and try to influence people to be more environmentally responsible with their behaviors.
So one of the big concerns then is bad behaviors on the part of recreators.
Right, absolutely. Because those bad behaviors tend to result in impacts. And those bad behaviors can be things that are potentially purposefully impactful, so things like graffiti. And they can also be behaviors that visitors are largely unconscious that they're doing. They're unaware of the impacts.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder how many of those visitors actually realize that they're doing something bad.
Right, and that's what largely information and educational campaigns in parks and protected areas are trying to get at. They're trying to provide visitors with information that the park assumes they don't know to help them behave in ways that that are less impactful. And so we're operating a little bit under like an information deficit model, right?
And that makes an assumption too, right? That
mm-hmm.
education and other interventions will actually be effective.
Right.
And so I guess that's part of the question for you, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely part of the question for me. That's some of the work that I've done addresses that question directly. And the answer is yes, but of course with a caveat, right? There are different modalities that you can use to employ specifically messaging, whether it's a volunteer in person giving a message or whether it's a sign that visitors can potentially choose to ignore. And the way that you choose to manage and provide that information definitely influences the effectiveness.
Okay, let's talk briefly about, you mentioned the theory of planned behavior, and I'm not particularly familiar with that, but I do know that humans tend to be pretty impulsive.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering how the planned behavior tied into these impulsive, potentially bad actions that recreators do.
Well, right. And I think you bring up a really good point there, that theory of planned behavior doesn't necessarily get at these impulsive behaviors. And their theory of planned behavior is one of many theories that are have been used and applied to understanding and managing visitor use in parks and protected areas. But understanding the nature of kind of these impulse behaviors and managing for that is something that has been understudied.
Good. Well, I'm glad you're addressing that.
Right.
I'm certainly tired of seeing people writing their name on rocks, so anything that we can do to reduce that would certainly be good. Let's talk about, not that that's the only thing they're doing. They're doing plenty of other despicable things.
like what, Stan?
Yeah, you know, actually, that's a good, I'm glad you asked that, Bella. Can you tell us about, I'm just out of curiosity, what's some of the worst recreation behavior that you've had to deal with or seen?
Oh, honestly, this is really funny because a colleague of mine was just interviewed by UPR and she ended up talking about this very same thing, but it's
people
poop.
People want to know.
It's poop,
of course,
right?
It is.
Of course it's poop. It's always poop. But yeah, when you come across impacts in parks and protected areas, we're out there mapping things like visitor-created trails, so trails that aren't the designated trail. We're mapping impacts to soil and vegetation, and yeah, inevitably come across piles of poop. So we spend time mapping poop, and that is one of the least fun things to encounter. Although I'll also say, and this is probably because I study recreation for a living, but being in really, really crowded areas. So we call kind of the entry point, so trailheads, and think around Old Faithful in Yellowstone National Park, right,
mm-hmm.
where there's lots of people. We call those front country areas, and being in those areas can be really overwhelming for me. So it's not necessarily something that impacts other people, and sometimes that's exactly the experience people are seeking in a park. But for me, when I have tons of other people around me on the trail, I feel a little claustrophobic.
But of course, those front country areas are also, as you have more visitors, right, I assume that, for example, bathroom facility is under higher demand, and so you
mm-hmm.
might have an increase in that behavior.
You do. Those areas tend to be kind of sacrifice areas. So you tend to harden surfaces, you pave them, you
mm-hmm.
put gravel down, you provide facilities, bathrooms with flush toilets instead of, you know, a porta potty because those use levels are so high.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually, Bella's gonna roll her eyes, Noah probably is too, but there is there are a couple different curves to explain the use impact relationship. And it turns out that with increased use doesn't necessarily come increased impact. The curve flattens out
oh.
at a point. It's curvilinear and asymptotic.
Oh, wow. Now we're getting technical. So a quote that I like that was sort of an axiom for a woman that won the Nobel Prize, Eleanor Ostrom, is that what works in practice can work in theory. And so I wanted to bring that to your work and ask how you see the practical research that you're doing feeding back into theory.
So primarily the work that we do and the way we get our funding to our work, right, because all research in academia has to be funded from somewhere, we're usually funded by parks and protected areas that have a particular issue that they need solved related to visitor use management. So the work we do is to help managers manage visitor behaviors appropriately in their setting, right? So ideally, observations that come about from continued management applications provide the fodder for a new theory.
Gotcha. That's good. Okay. So in that vein, let's talk about disciplines, because different disciplines tend to have different theories. And here at USU, the natural resource and sociology group seemed pretty tight. But when I got here, I realized that the psychology group really didn't have much play. And yet a lot of the things that you're doing are definitely in some of the realm of psychology. So I was wondering how you think about the different disciplines in the work that you do.
I definitely try to take a broad approach in terms of disciplines in the work that I do. You're right. I have used a lot of social psychology research in my work particularly, but in our particular institution, Utah State University, I have not worked directly with any psychologist whatsoever. Although you're right, we do work back and forth with the sociology department a lot more. And that may just be because of the nature of the kind of siloing of the different departments and the way that they're positioned, because psychology is grouped with the College of Education.
Mm-hmm. And to be fair, here, the psychology department does a lot of addiction research and other things that
don't
seem to have obvious impact in recreation.
Right, but a lot of the theory that I've utilized has come from social psychologists and people with psychology specific backgrounds, like Robert Cialdini is psychology by background. I've used a lot of his research, and he does research specific to kind of more environmental marketing almost and advertising.
Which in a way, I suppose the signs that you're testing and sorts of things in a way are sort of marketing for behaving differently and
mm-hmm.
have a similar sort of...
Yeah, absolutely. It's a different type of environmentally responsible behavior. So it may not be littering or trying to conserve electricity or switch your light bulb from incandescent to compact fluorescent, right? But it is trying to stay on trail to minimize impacts as opposed to just wandering wherever you want and trampling some kind of rare flower that's endemic to a specific place.
Okay. So what are the big opportunities that you see for cross-discipline work in the areas that you're studying? You said that you use some social psychology, but there are other areas that you
mm-hmm.
see opportunities for, or just maybe social psychology areas?
Well, yeah, other areas as well. So I've worked with on my committee and informing the research that I've done the College of Business here at Utah State. So again, that's where that kind of marketing and advertising psychology came into play. And definitely communications, right? That's super important. As a scientist trying to communicate with a broader audience, understanding communication theory is really important. And I think we can draw more heavily as a field from communication theory than we have in the past. And that's a vein that I would like to specifically pursue.
Okay. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and just talk about your life as a grad student or maybe things that you wish you had known going into grad school.
All right.
So, let's start with what are the top three things that you might tell a grad student coming in?
Oh boy.
Run.
Well, yeah, I'm going to go with that. But I'm going to take in a totally different direction than the way you're thinking. So the whole work-life balance is really important. Making time for exercise. So if running is your thing, making sure that you make time for that.
Wait, is running your thing?
It's one of my things.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm training for an ultra marathon right
now.
Wow. So that eats up a lot of time. I wouldn't necessarily advise any grad student to do that because, yeah, that's a significant chunk of time. But I'm kind of crazy. So there you have that. But, yeah, definitely find ways to keep that work-life balance. That may mean, you know, you're not necessarily going to work a 9-to-5, especially if you come from a 9-to-5 background. Being prepared to work evenings, weekends, take emails from your major professor, like at all hours.
Mm-hmm.
There's not really a time that's off limits, so you have to create that space. And as long as it's reasonable, then most people are willing to respect that time.
Do you guard certain time blocks from people that you're working with or your major professor?
Yes. You have to.
Okay. Yeah, you have to.
You have to create time for yourself, especially as if you're pursuing specifically a PhD and there are others in your lab that you're working with, you often become a mentor to other people. And it's really important in order for you to be able to give time to them to take time for yourself.
Right. And I assume that you've developed expertise doing your field work that you then have to help impart as well to
mm-hmm.
the people you're working with.
Yeah. So I've worn many hats. So mentor, actual grad student researcher, teacher, lab manager. Sometimes you have to do a little bit of it all, depending on what the field component is to your research.
Is there anything that you wish you had done differently going into grad school and working on your PhD?
Yeah, I've had a very positive experience, and I had opportunities because of my teaching background to start teaching right away. I haven't had to advocate for myself for that. I know many do.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to find a social group that I fit into right away, and so I was able to, it was a little easier to make time for that work-life balance when you have a crew to draw you away from work and to pull you away when you've been in the office for way too many hours.
Good.
Yeah, and I've had a wonderful opportunity with the research that I've been able to do. I've worked on a lot of different projects, which at times is stressful because a lot of the work that I've done hasn't gone towards my dissertation, but it's enabled me to think in different ways and has informed my overall development as a researcher, as a teacher.
And speaking of balance, but in this case not work-life balance, but work-work balance,
mm-hmm.
How do you balance other projects that come up and other things and getting your dissertation done?
Well, it took me 5 years to finish my dissertation, so if that's any indication. With us, especially working with parks as our clients, more or less, and doing research for them, there are deadlines that come up with reporting and providing information for parks, for different parks and protected areas. So sometimes, you know, the dissertation is put on hold for a minute so that I could complete other research tasks. And, you know, my advisor understands, obviously, because he is the one, you know, running the lab and our specific program, that nature. So he was totally fine, and my committee was as well, with saying, okay, yep, I understand you have to do this other work, so it's fine if the dissertation is put on hold for a little bit. But like I said, I think it made me a better researcher and thinker overall to be able to work on multiple projects.
Great. Okay. So, Abby, can you give us one of your stories to wrap up this show? Maybe a wildlife encounter or something like that?
Sure, yeah. We've had all kinds of fun wildlife encounters in the research that I do in the field. Probably my favorite one was when we were working in Grand Teton National Park. We were doing visitor counts at trailheads, and you know, we had to do manual counts. And there's one trailhead that had a resident fox who we named Don Julio. He would visit and pop in and out below our camp chairs that we had set up at times, usually when no one was around, and scare us pretty good. Yeah.
So was this a fox that was doing that just because you were out in the wild, or was this a fox that humans had sort of gotten used to getting some food, stealing some food?
Yeah, he had probably been a bit habituated to a human presence and had been able to steal food. Hopefully he hadn't been given food by anyone, but he was definitely looking for food, trying to sneak something out of our packs.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.